Conversation. It's episode 149 with William Simmons, art writer, art critic, lecturer in art history, interviewer, future editor of October and Vogue magazines, and great story, How We Met, which I'll get to in a second. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can find the image that connected Will and I, which is a funny little thing that we talk about, but go there, check it out. I saw the image, made me chuckle. I wrote him up via Twitter and said, hey, would you possibly be interested in coming on this podcast? He was like, that sounds great. So here we are. Really, really great guest. I think it was a great conversation. I'll let you be the judge of that. But yeah, the modest silliness of the tweet belied a serious intellect from a quite young person. I don't know his age. I don't want to know. I believe he's a millennial, right, Will? He's super thoughtful, charming, and so on. So I'm, without overselling this, I think you're going to enjoy it. If you haven't already taken the survey, please do. If at least take the questions 7, 8, and 9, those are very helpful to us in doing research for future programming for the show. It's theconversationpod.com/survey. And while you're there, of course, you can see that image. What else? Yeah, I mean, we really cover a lot of stuff. It's quite impassioned. Just to give you a heads up beforehand, in case you feel like there's any malice or anything otherwise foul in our disagreements. No, it was perfectly lovely, and he really enjoyed it, as you will hear. So, nonetheless, you know, there's some very civil butting of heads of sorts. You will hear. Before we get there, wanted to also remind you that when you subscribe to the podcast, The Conversation, an artist podcast on Stitcher, on iTunes, on whatever platform you use, if it's not those two big ones. If you subscribe, not only will you get episodes regularly coming to your feed, you will also get access to a lot of intriguing past episodes that were re-released about a month ago. They include episodes with curator Michael Ned Holte, artist Amanda Ross Ho, artist Jonas Wood, artist Rebecca Morris. The list goes on. The ladies from Night Gallery, very intriguing and strange episode. So if you haven't listened to those, go check those out if you're curious. And without further ado, let's get over to this conversation with William Simmons. I will talk to you more on the back end. Thank you so much for being here. I'll talk to you then. That makes sense?
Yeah. I'm very difficult to offend, although I appreciate you saying that.
Okay, good.
If you do think it's boring, you should just tell me it's boring.
Well, I think that's a great place to start. I find it pretty intriguing that you say that it's very difficult to offend you. Maybe that's on the conversational or casual level, but on the intellectual/critical/academic level, apparently you, mm-hmm. you can be offended by a number of things. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That is a good way to put it. Yes.
Okay. I want to, before we revisit that particular topic, I want to let you and listeners know how we connected. So I saw a tweet of yours, and I'm not sure how I saw it exactly, because it must have been a retweet or something like that. But it is an image of a Botero dude, and I actually, the way that I remembered him in my visual memory was as sort of a bishop or something like that. I'm mm-hmm. looking at him yeah. now, and I think it might be more like a guy wearing a hairnet or like a hospital scrub for the head. What would you say that image is?
I actually have no idea. You know, I saw that somewhere on Instagram, and what I've been doing lately is, you know, trying to repurpose those memes for an art world context, which is kind of dumb, but you know, it's fun.
Right.
But I feel like it was some sort of like bishop thing.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just anoint him a bishop rather than some sort of, you know, generic guy. But the most important, the punchline, if you will, is that in white lettering over this sort of dark yellow image of this guy, it has the letter Y and then the letters THO, which was totally the punchline. And I was like, I got to get in touch with this guy. Cause it was preceded by basically me whenever I interview artists.
I'm glad you got the joke.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sets up this great image of, it's almost like a Beckett waiting for Godot, you know, where the artist is sitting there, you know, blabbing on about something, and then you sit there and say, why though? And then he says something else, and you say it again.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it was also kind of like, I also find myself asking asking what I think in retrospect can be kind of dumb questions. You know, I sort of have a very hyper academic background, but sometimes, you know, I just find myself being like, why? like, uh-huh. which is sort of a reflection on me and on the artist at the same time. But
right.
I'm really glad you got the joke.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think it's really an interesting paradox, if that's the right word, that first of all, you're obviously very Twitter focused, because as I was going back into Twitter to try to find that particular tweet with the why though, which was like May 30th, I had to dig through quite a number of pages of tweets. Cause how many times a day would you say you tweet?
You know, it's been more recently. You know, I used to say I would do only, you know, things that I've written, or maybe like the occasional retweet of like a colleague. But now I'm just sort of at a point where, you know, I just sort of enjoy dicking around on Twitter, especially messing around with Artsy and ArtNet.
Right.
Who, as you mentioned earlier, you know, have been, you know, getting on my, have been, you know, I haven't been the biggest fan of them lately, but there's just, you know, I think Jerry Salt's very clear for everybody that social media was an important place where, you know, a very stuck up, arcane, insular art world could make, you know, important connections with the outside. And,
right.
And I sort of thought, you know, it's not helping with my PhD, but it's fun.
Right. Well, that's kind of where I was going, that paradox that I was mentioning, and you can help me out as an academic with the right word, but that you have both this, you know, your toes in very vernacular world and pop cultural world. You know, you interview artists for Interview, among other places. And then you're mm-hmm. also writing very academic / intellectual, you know, critical writing for more, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, hardcore journalism locations. And so do you find that there's some sort of reconciling that's going on, or is it more that you're kind of drifting or oscillating from one extreme to the other?
That's a good question. You know, this sort of more pop cultural engagement thing is fairly new for me. I mean, I for most of my career, if one wants to call it that,
right.
You know, I've been heavily steeped in, you know, the most arcane, difficult to understand art theory. You know, I studied with the October Journal people, and I learned a very rarefied language for talking about art. And you know, I think two things happened. The first was reading something that Jerry Saltz wrote for a catalog that he did a text for. It was called It'll come to me, but it included Jimmy DeSanta, who's the artist who I did my thesis work on.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this essay, and I remember that I was using it for my thesis in undergrad, and I was reading this quote by Jerry Saltz to my thesis advisor, who probably should go unnamed, but everyone knows who she is anyway. So, but she looked at me and she said, "Well, that's not correct." And I was like, "Well, you know, no, I don't remember what exactly it was. I should go back and read it." But it was a moment where I had a feeling that she only said it was incorrect because someone who is not, who doesn't have an Ivy League degree, was saying it. And that made me really think that there has to be something more, there has to be some way to combine the very important advances that theory has made in our history with, a populist understanding of how people actually interact with art. And then the other really formative experience in that regard was when out of the blue, Flaunt magazine in LA asked me if I wanted to feature Sue DeBeer. And I have no idea how they got my contact information, but that was the first time that I wrote something for a very pop culture oriented outlet. And since then I've done, you know, pop singers no one will ever hear of.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica Chastain for the cover, which was fun. And also Julie May Retu for their two covers ago. And I think that the editors that I work with over there and at Interview and at W, I think that they have things to say that are equally, if not more insightful than the people at Art Forum, because when you work at a general interest publication, you have to really understand, you have to think about why this is relevant beyond the fact that XYZ Gallery paid for a huge ad in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to say, people want to read this because,
mm-hmm.
and it also has to be in language that is both elevating the discourse and something that any sort of informed reader can pick up on. So, you know, to answer your question, I think, you know, I told a guy I went on a date with the other day, I said, you know, my goal is to be the editor-in-chief of Vogue and also the editor-in-chief of October. And of course, what a ridiculous thing to say and like how vain, but I don't know. I think there's room for both, and we'll just have to see where art criticism goes, you know?
Yeah.
I think that'll sort of help determine, you know, what my next step is, as it were.
Before I get back to October and Vogue and so on, can I ask how you met this guy? I mean, and I only say that because I'm curious what the...
It's a funny... It's actually a funny story.
Okay, good.
I met him because I was at the Portland Biennial two weekends ago,
mm-hmm.
and I changed my seat at the last minute, and I was sitting next to this guy, and he was cute, and he was wearing a Columbia sweatshirt, and I made a snarky comment about how I didn't get into Columbia, and he thought it was funny,
mm-hmm.
and we just ended up chatting for that whole 6-hour flight, and then he came out with me and my friends to a strip club in Portland.
Wow.
And at some point that came out of my mouth, but a lot of crazy shit came out of my mouth that
night. Right.
But that was actually the first time in a long while since like a Starbucks barista who I had gone out with someone who I'd met in real life.
Right. That's exactly where I was going. So it's the guy that you went out with on this date is somebody you met in person, but typically you meet people digitally.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, You know, when I'm in public, I'm usually sweaty and manic. So if you can sort of curate your online presence a little better.
Right.
And make yourself appear a little bit more normal and sexy than you actually are.
Well, you know, you just reminded me of something that was quite curious to me, which is the two avatars, if you will, of yourself. The one that you have on Twitter is sort of Mr. Bedhead, you know, kind of a PhD student, right?
Yeah.
And then the one on your Gmail, I guess your Google Plus or whatever avatar is like, what, you're like 16 in that picture?
maybe 17.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Quite old. Well, the one for my Instagram is one where I'm trying to look slutty, but you can't really tell because it's very small.
Okay, got it. Right. I was just like, when I first saw them, I took a closer look the other day and I go, oh, okay, this is just a difference of years. But when I first saw them, I thought, wow, this guy really is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know?
Well, you know, when Twitter picture is more recent. It's obviously more recent, but like I feel like it's, you know, maybe a month or two old. And to be quite honest, my family is not very hairy. Mm-hmm. And I think that I have a fascination with the fact that maybe like 6 months ago, I could start growing a really ugly, scraggly beard.
Right.
So I'm just sort of reveling in having facial hair.
Right.
I don't know.
So basically after 6 months, you get like the facial scruff that hirsute dudes would get in like 5 days?
More or less.
Yeah.
when that picture was taken, I remember... I took it for somebody, but I don't remember who. But whoever it was said, you need to shave.
Right.
And I've since cut my hair. So the hair is short and mm-hmm. the goat beard is gone.
Got it. Okay. And that's how you were when you met this guy on the plane?
Yeah. My hair was even longer.
Oh, interesting.
And it was even like I actually only got it cut yesterday to go on a second date with this guy, which ended up going poorly, but whatever.
Sorry to hear that.
It was very, very long. Like, I think I probably have an Instagram from a couple days ago where it, you know, it's like coming down to my shoulder. My mother would have a fit.
Interesting.
She would die.
Right. When you mentioned going out to Portland for the Oregon Biennial, or the Portland Biennial, I can't remember the name of it.
It was the Oregon Biennial, but
right.
It was revamped as the Portland Biennial.
Oh, okay, got it. It just made me wonder, are you kind of on the international art circuit? I mean, do you go to a lot of fairs and biennials, or is it pretty rare? Or
I went to Basel and I went to Manifesta, and you know, I do try to get around, but I think that you know, the thing about that when it comes to people who write about art is that more often than not, you know, they're taking money from a third party press organization. I save up and, you know, I make it happen. So in a sense, I try to get around, but I'm definitely not on the circuit because there's no one to send me because I'm a freelancer and I don't take, third-party funds.
Right.
But maybe someday I'll be that guy who just goes to everything because somebody pays for their ticket. I don't know. That's just not my truth at the moment.
But the things you do go to, you're paying your way.
Yeah. Loans.
Okay.
You know, teaching.
Right.
Because, you know, I think that allows for a more authentic experience and you're not being beholden to anyone, and you know, you can sort of, you're not being shepherd it around. And also, you know, I don't want to be that guy. You know, there are some art world people who are like people who are everywhere because, you know,
yeah,
they're either independently wealthy or they're getting sent there by whatever, you know, magazine they write for. And I'd rather utilize my funds for things that I have a personal connection to, you know, cause I'm not a journalist. Like, I'm not here to cover, you know, every biennial, every art fair.
Right.
The only time I would drop that kind of dough would be if I had some sort of personal investment in what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I think it's important to make the distinction because you have done pieces for Interview, you know, particularly, correct me if I'm wrong, artist interviews, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's very different. It's very different for you going in and doing an artist interview with somebody and submitting it to them than they're paying for you to go to Basel to write about, you know, XYZ, something fashion, you know, slash art oriented or whatever.
Right. Well, you know, I'm trying to think. I have never, no, I don't think I have ever been commissioned in that way, you know, to write a text somewhere far, you know, whenever I do, you know, I've done a few international reviews. I have one coming out in Flash Art, of Mary Heilman at Whitechapel. But whenever I do that, it's because I decided, you know, I need to be here for this. And I happen to have seen this show, or I found this particularly intriguing. And so I approach whatever editor. I've certainly been offered funds to go review things, but not by Interview, but by other organizations. And I always say no, but yeah, with, you know, with Interview, it's been really great working with them because I usually just say, you know, only one come to me and said, you should do this. And it was Thomas Beard's, Queer Cinema Retrospective. But more often than not, I just say, hey, I really dig, the first thing I did for them was Britta Phillips, who is not a visual artist, but a musician. And they, it's nice because I think that they trust my taste, which is flattering, but also, you know, very life affirming and, you know, coming out of a year plus of writing for Art Forum where they have to have an opinion about every little thing.
Right.
You know,
otherwise known as editing it to within an inch of its life kind of thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm an editor myself. I'm the art editor for Crush Fanzine, which is not like it's not a huge operation, but you know, we have Kiki Smith and Michael Shannon and, for the last issue, they did Lisa Phillips, and I'm doing Lucian Smith, actually, after I talk to you. And, you know, I edit things, and sometimes I, you know, the point is that I'm not one of those writers who says, don't touch my stuff. You know, I'm not at a Linda Yablonsky level where, like, you know, when she sends something in, they should just not touch it because it's probably perfect, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, I understand, you know, like Michael Famighetti and Brendan Wattenberg at Aperture, my favorite editors. I think it's because, you know, there's a difference between constructive editing and what usually the more sort of canonical art outlets do in terms of editing. You know, because the key, you know, is to find what a person is trying to say and help them amplify it and not try to pick intellectual quarrels with people. And the latter was sort of more something that happened earlier on. And I think people thought they could do it because I'm young. And I think that they also did it because they thought I would have to acquiesce because of their publication's prestige. And that's not true. And it's not productive. And I think I've learned more about how to create useful dialogues and pieces of writing for people inside and outside of the academy from interview flaunt, you know, freeze to W. But yeah, I think it's a matter of priorities. Like, are we as editors here to support the writer's writing, or are we here to toe some sort of conceptual line, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you're mentioning a number of different publications, and it's making me wonder from maybe the artist's perspective, because I think once you start to talk about the art world's perspective, it's the answer is much easier. But from the artist's perspective, what is the role of all of these articles, if you will? You know, you've got everything from October, you know, to Art Forum to, you know, the other end of the spectrum where you're getting more pop cultural, you know, and you've just got thousands of articles about these things. Now, from somebody working in a gallery's perspective, it's easy, you know. These are opportunities to add to the, you know, to the bio, to the CV of any given artist in our gallery. But as artists, my experience, and I'm kind of minimalistic in my reading of art material, and so I may be the exception. But I guess, and you can tell me what you perceive. But I guess that certain articles miscellaneous or random articles become kind of these talking points. Like somebody shared with me a W magazine article about the return of figurative painting, you know, not that long ago, you know, so it's like these occasional articles become these sort of talking points. Oh, you should check this out. You should check this out. You know, that kind of thing. Is that kind of the way from the inside you perceive it?
Well, you know, it's important. I've actually been thinking a lot about this, and I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with me on that, because it makes me think. You know, I have been thinking, you know, this is getting really existential, right? But I've sort of been thinking, you know, what is all of this sort of leading toward, right? You know, and returning to that boy who Lord knows will never listen to this, but he, you know, I went over to his apartment yesterday before we got lunch, and it was just this gorgeous place, and he was talking about like his corporate job, and so I sort of was thinking like, well, what am I doing, you know? But I think that at the end of the day, to respond directly to what you were asking, I don't think that I have ever I don't know if I have the capacity to write sort of an article like Fan's article in W, or like, you know, the occasional one that'll come out in Hyperallergic that everyone's talking about. I don't think that has ever been something I can do. I mean, you know, occasionally ArtF City will like say something snarky about something I wrote and then link to it. But, you know, I think that more my goal is to create things that are sustainable. And that's why I only write about artists that I like. I don't, you know, review a show because everyone else is talking about it, or I don't review a show because, you know, this, that, or the other person wanted me to. I think what I'm trying to do with all of these different outlets is really you know, firstly, to supplement my core academic research, and secondly, to really be able to pursue an artistic life, I guess, or an aesthetic life, or a part of the conversation, with themes and people that I find interesting. So it's like, you know, if I want to, you know, if I want to do a heavy duty review of, you know, Mary Heilman's show at Whitechapel, where I'm quoting Bataille, you know, there are places for that, because sometimes that's what I want to do. And specifically in Mary's case, you know, I thought that most of the writing on her was specifically anti-intellectual, right? But if I wanted to, you know, sometimes, you know, what if sometimes there are times where I'd want to talk to, you know, I wanted to talk to Jessica Chastain about her time at Juilliard and her favorite artists. And, you know, I think, because, you know, the discourse on her is specifically anti-intellectual in a way, too. I think it, maybe it sounds kind of scattershot, but I think it really comes down to me wanting to play a substantive role in the artistic conversation. But also, you know, and as you mentioned, being an artist, I think it's my role to help facilitate where I can an artist's truth, you know? Maybe facilitate is not the right word, but that's why I've been really enjoying doing interviews lately, because to create something more sustainable, you know, something that someone would want to have on their CV, something that someone would send to another journalist to say, you should read this before you interview me.
Right.
And that makes me feel really useful and good, because I'm able to play a part in amplifying the voice of someone who I already admire, and help people to come at their work in a new way. And I think that having a variety of outlets that I can turn to really makes that process easier. Because, you know, the people at whatever high-powered art magazine you want to choose, you know, what they do is they sit around, they have a huge spreadsheet of people they should write about. They have a set of, you know, corporate confines of what they can or cannot talk about. And yeah, they get a regular salary for it, but I know half the time they hate what they're writing about, you know?
Well, going back to when you mentioned the primary answer to my question, you said you want to contribute to sort of the archive, or I can't remember what the word you used, but the sort of the long-term conversation, essentially, you know, around these subjects. One of the main thoughts that I had is, when you do an interview, which you do many of, you know, do you feel like those are included in that historical catalog that you're referring to? Because to a certain extent, even though, you know, you and or your editor get the final edit, you know, those interviews are only partially in your control, right?
In terms of what?
In terms of, like, if you have a conversation with Lucas Samaras, who we should talk about in a little bit, you know, it could go in a direction that, you know, that you weren't intending it to, or maybe were even never imagined it would. And you're like, well, this isn't really what I had in mind in contributing to the either that artist's CV or the larger historical conversation.
Yeah, that'll happen. But, you know, I think probably it does sound trite to say that I enjoy that, but, you know, returning to Ben Subir and Flaunt, right? I met her at some coffee shop in by Washington Square, and I came with this, you know, super feminist, super like a very, what are you saying about women, and you must be talking about feminism, and you know, and she said to me, she was like, no, I'm not. I sort of thought to myself, you know, I like froze for a second, and she was like, you know, what I'm really talking about is beauty. And so that's what we went with. And I think that was such a formative thing for me, because no, you know, criticism should not be tailored to the needs of artists. And criticism, or, you know, artists don't have privileged access to the meaning of their work. And I believe that, I really believe that, you know, like I've written about Alan McCollum's work being queer, for instance. Like, I'm sure that would never be something he would talk about, but, and that doesn't invalidate, you know, what I'm trying to say, but I think that I've done a lot of sort of grand statements about what people are or are not doing. And I've had a lot of fun lately being surprised and being challenged and being taken in strange directions, because, you know, that's exactly what academia tells you not to do. You know, your point is to say, for example, Sue De Beer's work engages with feminist discourses of the blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's true, and that opinion is valid. And if someone were to write that dissertation, God bless them. Mm-hmm. But it was really formative for me to sort of sit there with the artist and have her say that's incorrect. And I think that that's not an opportunity that you get when you are in grad school. I mean, you know, this is really mean, but I saw in the student lounge at the Graduate Center a couple months ago, there was a flyer like, how to interview artists.
Wow.
I could just imagine my colleagues going to that and being like, well, you know, oh my God, which page of Lacan am I going to cite? <You know? laughs> which is like, fine, like, get it, you know, that's fine. But you know, there's something so much more satisfying about having your ideas be challenged. It doesn't necessarily have to change them. In the case of Sue, it did change my,
right,
you know, perception of things.
Right.
But in other instances, you know, I would hold resolute to what I was thinking. But, you know, I think that it's more of a back and forth than what people, academics, would have you believe. And I think there's a lot of power in that.
Right. I'm glad you brought up that example, because I do want to ask you finally, after all this time, about what, you know, what some of your more memorable interviews have been like. But before I forget, we'll get to that in a second, I wanted to ask you about if to what extent you feel like it's a challenge or you have reservations about interviewing or writing about essentially only canonical artists. I mean, just to take a sample, and I'm sure you have plenty of exceptions you can cite, but just to take a sample of people that, some interviews that you did that you recommended to me, there's Luke Toymans, there's, mm-hmm, Lucas Samaras, there's Martha Rossler, and there's Felix Gonzalez Torres. And I know there, I'm sure, Sue De Beer, and then probably much less known artists that you've covered as well. But generally, correct me if I'm wrong, my sense is that, you know, on one hand, I get it, you want to write about artists who you're interested in, and these are some, mm-hmm, of the artists who you are and have been interested in. But I wonder if, on the other hand, if you're just perpetuating, you know, the canon that's already out there.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably right in a sense. I think you're probably right. And, you know, my best friend, Anthony Iacono, who's a fabulous artist in his own right, mm-hmm, we cut in a in a spat because he said that I only review shows in Chelsea galleries. So this kind of reminds me of that too. You know, it's true. It's true. And I think what I would say in response to that would just be that I think at this stage, I think that I personally can do more good by attempting to work within the canon than I can, you know, doing, not writing about canonical artists. I think that, and that's a total cop out, you know, but I think the unfortunate fact, I think, is that one is going to create a much more potent and wide-ranging conversation, for example, if you talk about, I'm trying to think of a good example, if you talk about if you write about queerness in Alan McCollum's work, who's like as canonical as you can get, or queerness in Richard Prince's work, or talking to Luke Toymans about feminization and the melodramatic, I think it does create more of an impact than writing about people that nobody's heard of. And that's awful. It's awful. But, you know, I think that I did actively try to combat that when I did my top 10 for Nada at Interview. And I think that were I to do more things like that, I think that's a good outlet.
Right.
To do, you know, but the fact of the matter is that you can write about, if you don't break into the canon, the unfortunate fact is, one, no one will care, and two, you won't be able to build a career such that people read what you write. You know,
right.
That's maybe careerist. Maybe right. That's careerist. I mean, tell me if you think that's careerist, but that's just sort of, you know, that's just sort of the way.
Well, I think the question,
I don't know if,
you know, should I continue?
Ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the question that you just raised is, and this might be implied by your email signature, you know, which says that your PhD program in art history, certificate in women's studies, is your, you know, the way we've been talking thus far suggests that you, as you said yourself, want to be the editor of a cross between October and Vogue, or maybe both at the same time. But do you want to be a professor in art history as well? Or what is the goal?
Well, you know, I technically am sort of, I'm a lecturer
right.
at the City College
right.
where I teach intro to art history. And I think that the answer to, you know, this connects to what you just asked, you know, I think the answer to that would be no, because that is the ultimate perpetuation of the canon. I mean, something I neglected to say that this reminds me of is that if you pitch it, it's very rare, unless you're writing for Hyperallergic, for instance, that you can write about somebody who is not already notable.
Right.
You know, it's very rare.
Right.
And in the case of academia, if you I mean, it's the history of Western art since the Venus of Willendorf. If you don't cover certain, then you're not doing your job. Even though, you know, most of my time talking about Greek classicism is spent telling the undergrads how Greek classicism was the basis for, you know, all kinds of problems of essentialism, racism, homophobia, mm-hmm. straight up Nazism, mm-hmm. Nazi aesthetics, you know,
right.
That's what I end up talking about
right.
more. But, you know, in both instances, you do have to operate within a set of certain confines. But if you're affiliated with an institution, but you're also doing these other activities, you can begin to take things in a different direction. I mean, I hope that there will be a day when I could write something about somebody nobody's heard of
right.
and have it make some sort of a huge impact.
Right.
You know, I think that hopefully will be the case.
I think we just arrived at the equation. Sorry to interrupt, but I think what you just articulated is, to put it in a very simple terms, this might be oversimplifying and you can tell me if it is, but I think being that you're a young writer / academic, you know, you're at a phase where, okay, I need to grow my what's the right word here? I don't know if it's career, brand, or, you know, or CV. You know, I need to grow sort of my writing bibliography, you know. And then when I have reached a certain point, then I can sort of turn around and apply my reputation, you know, my bona fides, and apply them to underknown or unknown artists, right? Flip it
right,
around.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's only just now that I've started to be unafraid writing, you know, pissing people off with the hyperallergic thing. I recently published something about Simone Lee that Artsy wouldn't publish. It's only recently that I've started really, I Instagrammed something absolutely idiotic that Barry Schwabsky said. It's only recently that I sort of feel that I'm allowed to do that. But, you know, I think that this connects to a larger issue of the fact that the number of young people coming out of highly qualified liberal arts programs who probably got an art history degree who want to write about art is, you know, there's 10 of them for every spot.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that, and again, this is not something that I feel good saying, but I think it's true. If you come out trying to write about art and you are not thinking long term, if you are not thinking about building a body of work and a body of colleagues and a body of aesthetic concerns, you won't last. You know, if you write a flamey article for Hyperallergic about how you're mad about XYZ,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's beautiful. It's fine. But, you know, that's, you can't do that right away. And I think maybe that's a millennial thing. I think maybe it's a thinking we have a right to have an opinion about everything sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's important. But at the end of the day, I think that you have to keep in mind that the art world, if one wants to use so pretentious a moniker, it's like a small town, you know, and you have to think about how you can exist productively in that community such that you have a platform to be critical,
mm-hmm.
Such that you are able to convince people that something is truly awry and that you're not just a privileged, you know, kid who sits in a coffee shop in his early 20s who has opinions about everything, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
And that's not to say that young writers shouldn't go out on a limb or that they shouldn't call out injustice when they see it, but it just means that in order for your voice to be effective, you have to learn how to walk a thin line, and I guess most importantly, make your writing ultimately generative. I'm thinking specifically of an interview I did with Jack Pearson for Art in America, where I actively did it, and he knows this, you know. I actively did it because I didn't understand his show at Chime and Reed of the small watercolors. I didn't get it. I thought it was a little out of touch, you know. And I did the same thing with David Sally with his last show at Skarsgård. It didn't resonate with me at all. And those were instances where I wanted to make it known that I wasn't, you know, totally on board with these shows, but that I wanted to sort of direct the conversation in a way that's not, that's actually generating more of a conversation. And, you know, with both of them, you know, I knew Jack for a while because he knew Jimmy DeSanta, but I hadn't met him, but I knew him through phone and email. But, you know, talking to both of them, I wasn't like, oh, I suddenly love David Sally's work, or, oh, I suddenly like this show of watercolors. But what I was able to do was to show my reservations and then talk through them in a productive way. And I think that, because, you know, these people aren't going to go anywhere, and people continue to make art. You might like the next round of stuff they make. You might not. You know, maybe Cindy Sherman will make something I hate someday.
Right.
And, but you have to learn how to exist productively among these people who are your peers.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Russeth, your fellow New York writer of Art News, were talking about this situation, this challenge of writing about canonical artists. We were using the example of Richard Prince, you know, when he did the, you know, both when he did this show that was a one-work solo show, and, you know, and I guess that it implied also the other things that he had been doing recently. But just the challenge of, you know, when you have these people who already are getting so much ink, does it really make sense to sort of add to that conversation? I think, I'm trying to remember, it was a very sort of subtle takeaway, but it was something to the effect of, you have to weigh in if nobody else is, you know, if this is fucked up, you know, if it's not being covered yet, you know, you have to weigh in, basically. But I think there's a real challenge there because, you know, obviously, like with the Instagram, you know, thing, that was just a pile on, you know. So at what point does that have anything to do with, you know, your being involved in the conversation as a writer, you know? Let's just talk about what the ideal here is. The ideal is to have something that both rises you up as a writer and gets you into the conversation and is something that is not already talked about to death. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that, you know, and I hope this doesn't sound vain, but I think that when I do write about canonical artists, you know, you won't read what I wrote anywhere else.
Right.
You know, you won't see, I very actively, and it's not like a anti-establishment or avant-garde gesture, but I very actively make sure that what I'm writing is something that can't be duplicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and I was having this conversation at a dinner a few weeks ago, and a curator said to me, he said, you know, it seems that you have some kind of an opinion on everyone, but everyone's already talked about to death, you know? And, you know, I should have sent you my Sherry Levine thing that I did for Crush, but mm-hmm. I mean, Sherry Levine's like the ultimate, everyone's written about her, but
right.
I like to think that when I do write about canonical artists, I do approach it in a fresh way, and hopefully in a feminist and a queer feminist and a activist minded way. I like to think that's the case. I like to think that that hilarious conversation with Lucas Samaras would never happen with anybody else. I like to think that. Maybe I'm just being vain. I don't know. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's like, I don't know, everyone has a different take on lasagna or something. And some are better than others.
Let's actually, I think this is a great transition to actually go to that Lucas Samaras. I thought it would be better if we, you know, if we acted out that exchange, just the beginning of it, you know, and you can be yourself and I'll be Lucas Samaras. And, you know, in that way we can give people a taste of that exchange.
Oh, boy.
What I was going to suggest is we just go from the beginning of the interview itself, where you say, I'm really interested, to the one where you say, I know that you predated much of this conversation. So just those like six okay. lines. Okay?
Okay. Okay. So you want me to read?
Yeah. I just want you to be yourself, you know, and try to be organic about it. Like as if you're face to face with him at a cafe.
Okay.
Okay. Ready.
I'm really interested in how, with Jimmy DeSanta, Laurie Simmons, Cindy Sherman, in your work as well, we don't...
No, you can't bundle the past together. I'm one of the parrots, so you can't put them and me together. That would be ridiculous, which is fine. I like that position.
Well, no. But what I'm thinking about is how in the 80s in photography, there was an interest in the surrealist legacy, and I don't know that we've quite put our finger on what exactly that relationship was. How does the surrealist legacy factor in?
Hang on. You're not talking about surrealism. You're talking about traditional photography, which, of course, you have Robert Frank and so on. Then all of a sudden, there are artists who are now photographers who pick up a camera without going to photography school. It is a totally different way of looking at photography. Almost naive in a way. Crude, naive, but also kind of daring.
So where do you locate yourself within all of this?
Well, I'll give you the dates, and you figure it out.
I know that you predated much of this conversation. That's why I'm finding this work to be so interesting. I wonder how you locate your influence. Sometimes it's good to hear from the source.
Okay, and then it goes on from there. So I just wanted to give people a taste of that. And I also wanted to go back to what I had wanted to get into a while ago, which is what, first of all, when you do interviews with artists, how are they often in person? Are they typically over the phone? What is the majority of the interchange?
They are, I'd say 90% of the time in person.
Okay, great. So tell me about some of the most memorable exchanges you have. Have you ever had an artist walk out on you? Have you ever, you know, just had the shit knocked out of you, you know, and like had a hard time recovering, what have you?
No, I don't think I have any. Let me think. I feel like I don't have any. Well, you know, oh, I shouldn't say this. I've had interviews where people who I thought were very interesting were, in fact, incredibly boring.
Sure.
But And I think I've, well, okay. You know, I think when, and this isn't an art person, but when I interviewed Zachary Quinto for Crush Fanzine, mm-hmm. I went off on this very lengthy discussion of how my friends and I would stalk him when he was in a play at Harvard. And if you listen to the audio, mm-hmm. it's just so spectacular how uncomfortable he clearly is. But let me think, you know, I mean, the interview with Jack for Art in America was rather combative.
Mm-hmm. He was doing a lot of defending himself.
I didn't send that to you, but that was one where I said that I thought his work was reminiscent of Gauguin's imperialist masculinism, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course, he didn't take kindly to that. Mm. But it wasn't mean-spirited, you know? And I don't think anyone's feelings were hurt. And way back in the day, in like 2011, I interviewed Kate Millett for the Harvard Independent, and she was very unhappy to be speaking to a man, which I understand, you know.
Can you just describe who Kate Millett is? Because I don't actually know myself.
Kate Millett wrote Sexual Politics, which was sort of, it's one of the foundational texts of women's studies, where she looks at the masculinist tendencies of high modernism in literature. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Norman Mailer, et cetera. It was sort of considered a real watershed moment for women's studies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was back when I was a kid. And I think...
5 years ago?
More than one. Well...
You were a kid 5 years ago. Wow.
I mean, I'm more of a kid.
Right.
I think... you know, I think I have more success stories than I do. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody once told me, said, you know, Will, you're not a good interviewer. You're a good freelancer.
Wow.
Because you know, I'm just not a combative dude. Mm-hmm. If someone put me in a room with Richard Prince, for instance, I might be, but I don't tend to find, because I'm rarely commissioned to do these things. I'm doing things that I would, you know, I love Jack Pearson's work. I think he's so smart. So I was coming to that interview thinking, like, am I missing something here? You know, or like, what is different about this operation? Mm-hmm. You know, I actually don't think I've ever been commissioned. The only time I can think of that I was asked to do an interview that I normally wouldn't have, I mean, a couple times for Flaunt with like musicians and stuff, but the only time I can think of was Julie Mayretu for the cover of Flaunt. Mm-hmm. Who I, you know, I know her work, but she wasn't previously someone who I thought about all the time. I mean, now she is, but so, you know, I tend to come to these things, you know, without a bone to make me a good interviewer, but, you know, maybe for an exclusive, because I don't think I've told anybody this, when I interviewed, and it was more of a feature, I did a narrative feature, mm-hmm. but before I did it, I interviewed Deb Cass before her show at Kasman. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody knows this, but I did not, like, I had all of her books, mm-hmm. And what I was going to do was look at them in the morning. And I was meeting her at like 10 or something. And I woke up at like 9:30.
Right.
And I lived in Park Slope at the time, and she was in Gowanus. So it wasn't like a nightmare, but I just, you know, sped through that monograph, rolled up to her studio late, unshowered, really had no idea what was going on. And because I had no idea what was going on, I said, so what do people not understand about your work? And it ended up being an incredibly productive conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, afterward, you know, now, Deb, if you're listening, I know her work backward and forward, right? But
mm-hmm.
That was an instance where it could have been disastrous, but
right.
I narrowly avoided disaster.
And so you're making me think that you're this young writer, you know, arriving either at the home or if not maybe a cafe nearby the home of you know, some of these really big name artists. Did you feel, if not more recently, early on, you know, kind of intimidated, or were you too confident to feel intimidated, or what?
Yeah, I'm still intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
Even by people who I've known for years and who are my friends.
Mm. How does that work?
And that's, well, I mean, not in like, you know, I'm doing a portfolio of work by Marilyn Minter and Laurie Simmons for a new fashion magazine called King Kong. And, you know, they were like, well, are you going to interview Marilyn? And I was like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And like the thought of you know, like it was terrible, but it's because, you know, I really truly do have such reverence for artists, not so much for curators, let's be honest. You know,
mm-hmm.
You can roll out of bed and curate something.
Depends on where, but, what you're curating for, actually. Right?
But with artists, you know, I really venerate them, and I really look up to them. And I think it's because, you know, the profession of being an artist is so foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's still really novel, and maybe there'll be some day where I could just like, you know, chat up, I don't know, Luke Toymans, for instance, who is terrifying,
mm-hmm.
and not be afraid. Maybe mm-hmm. that'll happen.
Right.
But it's not, you know, I was more afraid of Luke Toymans than I was of Jessica Chastain. When they asked me to do Jessica Chastain, I was like, who the fuck is that?
Oh, okay. You know? There you go. And
then,
yeah.
And then everyone was like, Will, what? But it's like, you know, these are people who have made really, truly tangible contributions to culture. These are people who are, you know, changing a variety of conversations for the better. These are people who are actually creating things in the world that have meaning. That, and if they're not activists, they're at least, you know, making their mark on the planet, you know? And maybe I shouldn't have that kind of mythology in my head. I don't have it about everybody, but that's just sort of, yeah.
I think mythology is actually a very good word, because as you were saying that, I was thinking when you use the word culture, maybe you mean art, or maybe I think you should mean art, because I don't think Luke Toymans, I don't think Marilyn Minter, I don't think Deborah Cass, I don't think any of these people have really contributed anything to the world beyond the art sphere. This is a conversation that goes back to something that I talked about with Ben Davis, which is to what extent art trickles out down, you know, or trickles out into the world. And there are sort of more superficial examples that you can find all over the place. But I'm very suspicious that, you know, those kinds of things permeate the larger world rather than just sort of the more the visual art world.
I would have to heartily disagree, at least in the case of Deb, Cass, and Marilyn Minter. Luke Toymans is not necessarily making, no, he's not. But, you know, Deb just did that addition to support Hillary. It's very affordable. You know, it's both very art historical and very accessible. Deb and Patty, you know, have always been activists. I think Deb's work, even though it does sort of deal with this very high-minded modernist mode, I think what she's doing is pointing to something much wider ranging. For instance, you know, her reappropriations of Warhol's work, her sort of insertion of a very queer history with Barbra Streisand, et cetera. And Marilyn is one of the most, more than Jeff Koons, I would say, probably the most visible visual artist in pop culture. And, you know, I don't like Miley Cyrus. I think she's awful. But I think Marilyn's recent work with Planned Parenthood is so important. You know, Marilyn was in on that. Laurie Simmons was doing that, and Cindy Sherman. Like, no, they're not necessarily putting up billboards. You know, they're not the Gorilla Girls.
Mm-hmm.
But what Marilyn has done, I think, has really, at the very least, she has shown how someone in a position of privilege that I believe was earned because she was not a hotshot artist for her entire life, how a person in a position of privilege can do something very positive, even if they're in an industry that's somewhat insular. You know, she was like, I'm going to make this bigger, and it's still going to be my art, but it's going to be something that, you know, you go to Marc Jacobs, you buy a shirt, and you're helping, you know, maybe to people who are, I think that being very progressive can also make you very cynical. And I'm not saying that applies to you. You know, I'm just saying that a lot of people I know gave me shit for being like, yeah, Marilyn by Miley. But it's also like, what are y'all doing to help the world? Nothing.
Right.
I don't mean you, again. I just mean people in general. And I think that if you want art to be part of a larger cultural conversation, it can be.
Yeah.
I mean, Jeff Koons is not doing it by putting things in, you know, Rockefeller Plaza, sure.
Right.
But, you know, Marilyn took out, you know, in the early 90s, she took out an ad during Arsenio Hall, you know, like no one else has done that, you know? I think that if anyone in the art world could, you know, really cross that barrier, I think Marilyn's doing that. I think Laurie Simmons is doing that. I think Deb Cass is doing that in a bit more of a, in a bit more of a artist-centered way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're all doing it.
What you're talking about is an artist who has reached a certain level of recognition and power right, if that's not the right word, leveraging that access and recognition to help a cause, right? That's what it, that's, I mean, if you, I know this is maybe sounding a little more cynical than you would like, but I'm just sort of putting it out there that what you're describing with that, with the Hillary campaign and with the Planned Parenthood, you know, is that they're sort of lending their, both their talents and also their kind of accessibility, if you will, their crossover appeal to these different contexts and helping to raise money, and which is a great thing.
Crossover appeal. Mm-hmm. I think that that diminishes. I think you're, but I don't think you're incorrect. But I think that saying the term, you know, that always sort of makes it sound less rigorous, you know?
Crossover appeal?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How so? Let's break it down. How so?
Because, well, for instance, with Marilyn Minter, Cindy Sherman, and Laurie Simmons, I think that very often, Nicole Eisenman being in W and The Nation and all these things when she used to, you know, and now is having a much wider appeal, or Sally Mann's another great example. Mm-hmm. These people whose work is sort of, I don't know, maybe more acceptable to the culture industry. I think that there is this understanding that that makes them less radical. And I just think that we have to be careful, especially when we talk about female artists, and especially when we talk about female artists who are working with fashion, mm-hmm. that we don't make it sound like dilettantism, or that it's not conceptually rigorous. Because, you know, I think that's one way that we diminish women's work, especially women who are able to succeed in multiple contexts. If you look at, you know, no one, I mean, even when you talk about Robert Mapplethorpe and fashion, mm-hmm. there's still sort of an understanding that Mapplethorpe was doing something, you know, avant-garde, or that he was doing something transgressive. But, you know, the fact that Marilyn has, you know, an advertorial in Purple is like, oh, you know, that's like too much. You know what I'm saying? Even though I think that what, a lot, especially, you know, I think it maybe I keep bringing up the same people because I think it connects very specifically to the photo conceptualists / pictures generation folks, mm-hmm. who are predominantly women. Mm-hmm. I think that it's something that affects them because maybe, you know, they were originally breaking down the structures of avant-garde culture, and maybe, of normative culture, you know, but maybe the culture industry has been allowed to co-opt that. But I think that as critics and historians, it's our job to sort of continue to point out why what these people are doing is still revolutionary. You know, the fact is that, yes, some of Marilyn's work does look like an ad for Maybelline, mm-hmm. but it's, mm-hmm. It's not. It's part of a very lengthy, very detailed and rigorous excavation of patriarchal norms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think on the flip side, I think that it shows us that fashion photography should not exist in a purely anti-intellectual, hyper-feminized space that we don't pay any attention to. I think that it's sort of important to take, it's important to take in the multimedia, multi-genre facts of 21st century life.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see if I can summon up some of the thoughts that I had as you were saying that. I didn't intend to imply dilettanteism, although I could see how maybe that was implied from what I questioned, because I don't, that's not a concern of mine. I don't think that's what's going on. I think the word co-opting is really important here. I think that's kind of at the root of this. So can you have this work be both revolutionary, as you called it, and have it be co-opted at the same time? In other words, if Marilyn Minter is making this, this is the metaphor that keeps coming up for me. It's the Trojan horse metaphor, right? Because here you have this artist making this, you know, let's say to some degree revolutionary imagery with revolutionary concepts. And she's marching this Trojan horse out into the larger culture through perhaps the prism of the fashion industry, right? So what then, once the horse is opened, what comes out? What is released? Does what comes out of that Trojan horse then instantly become co-opted because, you know, it's now a product that is being sold at Marc Jacobs? You know, I don't know. I honestly, I should say just, you know, by way of disclaimer that I'm not familiar with that campaign, so I can't weigh in specifically on that. But what I'm challenging simply, and I also want to preface this by saying I'm not picking on these women, you know, because I know that feels like the wrong direction to you. I'm just, mm-hmm. I'm just picking on any really established artist, and whether it's a male, female, transgender, et cetera, and what that artist's impact is outside of the you know, the sort of bubble of the art world, you know. And I think you're making a good point that there definitely are at least some reverberations that are felt, you know, but how significant are they versus an endeavor that is not a Trojan horse endeavor, but rather a more explicit endeavor to change the world? That's kind of my general sort of skepticism.
Right. Well, I think there has to be room for both, because, you know, the people, LaToya Ruby Frazier, for instance, who makes vehemently activist works, or Martha Rossler,
right,
you know,
right,
that are unabashedly activist works. That's an important endeavor, you know, it is. At the same time, you know, the fact of the matter is that different people, different audiences would encounter those works in different ways. And if someone is putting something, you know, if Cindy Sherman doing those covers for Harper's that she did maybe a year ago, you know, yes, it's on the cover of Harper's. You know, yes, it's, you know, nobody's going to go march in the streets over it, you know. But it's also like, if these people are getting paid, if these specifically female artists are getting paid to do an editorial in Purple, Harper's, New York Mag, etc., mm-hmm. who are we to tell them that they shouldn't, because it would make their work less avant-garde, you know?
Right.
That might not be directly answering what you're saying, but it's also kind of like, was anyone, I don't know, I feel like even the question of Jeff Koons' collaboration with Lady Gaga was met with less skepticism than Marilyn Minter having a spread in Purple, or I'm trying to think of, what's another good example? Warhol, like, he did a fucking album cover, right? And no one's like, oh, well, you know, his work was really commercial and well, you know, I think it's a problem specifically with the way people perceive women. And I think it's also a problem specifically with the way people perceive fashion.
Mm. Well, are you suggesting that there have been articles criticizing these things you're talking about? Because I'm not doing that. I don't know if you were under the impression that I was.
Oh, no, I'm saying that there is this... I think that you're asking questions that come from a good place. But what I'm saying is that I do think that there is very much this air of elitism, sexism, and an aversion to women being successful.
Right.
I think that, you know, because like I said, a lot of my close friends, for instance, gave me shit for, you know, being all about Miley and Marilyn on social media. Because, like, yeah, Miley Cyrus sucks, but it's also like I myself am not an activist. And I did get in trouble for saying that at a conference a couple weeks ago, but it would be vain for me to say that I'm an activist.
Well, how did you get in trouble? How did you get in trouble?
Well, I was giving a lecture on Judy Chicago in Bordeaux for her. She has a big show in Bordeaux, and the French are all, it was a bunch of, you know, it was largely populated by French students. You know, they're all very Marxist. And
okay,
my other, well, you know,
yeah,
more
no.
Marxist than we are.
Right.
And they were all like, well, you know, by articulating that, you're removing yourself from the possibility of like being a revolutionary. And it was in the context of, you know, Judy Chicago, who is very much an activist. And it was because one of the other panelists gave sort of a very social historical reading of Woman House specifically, and mine was based on theory. And I think that it was my commitment to theory has also played into this, in that it sometimes my work does read as ahistorical, but that's a whole other conversation. But the point is that I think it would be vain to say that I'm an activist, because I'm not.
Right.
I should be, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if an artist wants to utilize the platform that they've been afforded through hard work to do something positive in the world, you know, I can't be mad about that.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think let's go back a few minutes in our, you know, in the heat of our conversation, our exchange, because I think one of the big takeaways that bubbled up for me is that I think you made me check myself about the challenging women's success. I mean, I'm not saying that on any overt level I was doing that, but you were saying, you know, Jeff Koons and this collaboration with Lady Gaga, which I don't ever recall being conscious of. But in any case, you were saying, I don't think he's getting flack for that. And here these women are, you know, presumably getting a lot of flack for these projects. And I think I found myself thinking deeper down, I wonder if my instinct, you know, which has been bred into me presumably through our Western patriarchal traditions, you know, is if a woman gets to be a big, you know, big shot artist along the lines of Richard Prince or Jeff Koons, you know, that I'm going to shoot them, that my instinct is to be to shoot them down or to try to pop their bubble a little bit, you know. Whereas with Koons or Damien Hirst, you just kind of go along with it. You go, oh, yeah, whatever, you know. But the women, you know, your sort of deep down gut instinct is to go, no, that's, we gotta pop that bubble, you know. So I found myself checking myself a little bit. And I think all that to say that I think that, to me, is a really important point that you raise. And I know that that's really very core to your sensibilities, right?
Well, I think you articulated it really clearly and better than I did. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, and that's why I always have a problem with these, like, most expensive women artist list or whatever. It's like, how about we just let them do their shit? You know, because like,
right.
Cause like they couldn't vote like not all that long ago.
Yeah.
So it's like, can we just like let them live? You know, if Marilyn wants to, you know, if Marilyn gets X dollars for a painting and everyone's mad about it and, you know, oh my God, she is a studio assistant. It's like, that's like so meaningless to me. It's, in fact, I think it's something to celebrate that someone who's been in the art world for like ever is, you know, finally getting prices that are on par with, well, no female artist is getting prices that are on par with men. Almost on par with men.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yep. Definitely. So where do we go from here?
Well, you're in charge.
Ah, yes. Why, though?
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't know if we can top that. We might have to just call it the end of the day. What do you think? I mean, is there anything you feel remiss that we didn't get to?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, excellent.
Sure. That was very fun.
Well, it was fun. It was. I'm glad that we could rise to a level of passion and engagement that we did. So thank you so much,
absolutely.
Will.
Absolutely. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And we're out. Wow. Thank you so much again to William Simmons. Really enjoyed that. He did as well. So all is forgiven. If you have thoughts on the episode, I would very much love to hear your thoughts. It's been a while since gotten some intriguing feedback from you guys. So let's hear it. Let's hear what you think. Want to take this time to remind you that you can support the show a number of ways. One way that would be fantastic is if you go to iTunes. Presumably you're a subscriber to the show on iTunes, The Conversation, An Artist Podcast. Even if you're not, you can still leave a nice review with 5 stars, ideally. It helps more people find this show, which is always extremely helpful. Of course, you can also donate to the show, theconversationpod.com/support. Your support is very much appreciated at all times. And, of course, you can follow the show on social media. We're getting close to a big landmark number on Facebook. If you are that landmark number liker of the podcast, I've been talking about a trip to St. Kitts. So I've been talking about it. Who knows what's going to happen? You'll only find out if you get to be that big number on Facebook. You can follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Artist Podcast. And spreading the word, of course, also very much appreciated. And if you have any questions, thoughts, ways that you would like to be involved with the podcast, all very welcome through theconversationpod.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being here. I look forward to celebrating episode 150 with you next week. I am out of town on a little mini vacation as this comes out. So hope that I am relaxing and whatnot. I hope you are as well. I hope you're staying cool. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.